Daniel Levy has fallen. What's his legacy?
I think it'd be unfair to call him a failure the way younger Spurs fans do, because they don't remember the state of the club when he took over. But it is fair to say that he could have done better on the pitch.
Can London City compete at the top of women's football?
I certainly expect them to have a top half finish, but look out for London City Lionesses in the future.
And it was another great night for Lionel Messi. Hello, I'm Ian McIntosh and welcome to Route 1, your daily digest of news from around the world. It's football, fast, no faff. Let's go Route 1. Daniel Levy has fallen. The Tottenham executive chairman of nearly 25 years has stepped down with immediate effect. It's a huge shock. No one saw this coming, including most members of staff at the club, according to Jack Pitt-Brooks' excellent long read on The Athletic. It seems Levy's relationship with the Lewis family, who own the club, had gradually deteriorated. An internal review had been held at the start of the year into the reasons for Tottenham's apparent aversion to trophies. And while Spurs did, of course, win the Europa League a few months later, they also finished 17th. Manager Ange Postecoglou paid the iron price shortly afterwards, and now it seems that Levy has gone the same way. But was it all bad? When Levy took the reins in late 2000, Spurs were valued at about £70 million, and they were generally a bottom-half club. They finished 14th, 11th and 10th in the 3 years before he arrived. Now they're estimated to be worth over £4 billion. They have one of the greatest stadiums in the country, and with the exception of last season, they haven't finished outside the top eight since 2008 and the year of 2 points from 8 games. So how do we assess his reign? Well, we asked Danny Kelly, of course. He's the host of the brilliant View from the Lane podcast, and here is what he makes of it all.
So Daniel Levy, the Premier League's longest-serving chairman, has gone. What will be his legacy? First and foremost, we have to admit that he's been a great success in many ways. When he joined the club at the turn of the century, its arse was hanging out of its trousers. Now it's one of the top 10 richest clubs in the world, globally recognised, and plays its football in a cathedral of sport. But running a good business is not the same as running a good football club, and there's where the doors begin to open and close for Daniel Levy. Yes, it's been a very good business, but the Spurs have not won the things they might have done in the time of his tenure, especially when you consider that for a decade he had in Son and Kane, two of the best players in world football, playing up front, but they didn't invest in the team to back those up, and so they fell short of the fans' expectations. It's fair to say as well that the world has changed around Daniel Levy. A quarter of a century ago, he would have been dealing with other successful English businessmen. Now, of course, the game in England is run by people from oil-rich states in the Middle East and faceless American investment houses. It's a very, very different world. And I'm not sure that Daniel Levy was prepared for that anymore. Certainly, it seems that the people who actually own the majority of the club want to see a change. And so he has gone. I think it'd be unfair to call him a failure the way younger Spurs fans do, because they don't remember the state of the club when he took over. But it is fair to say that he could have done better on the pitch. And the success of his resignation will be measured in entirely that. If Spurs improve and become a force again in the sort of trophy-winning department of English football, then his departure is something to be celebrated. But I also take the view you have to be very careful what you wish for, because who comes next is the critical issue for Spurs fans.
And you can check out View from the Lane wherever you get your podcasts. There's a link in the episode description. The new WSL season is mere moments away as Chelsea begin their 6th consecutive title defence against Manchester City at 6:30. But we want to zero in on the WSL rookies stepping into the top flight for the first time. London City Lionesses have arrived with fanfare after winning the Women's Championship, renamed WSL 2 now, of course, last season. They've strengthened considerably, and with good reason. Their season starts tomorrow at 1:30 away to European champions Arsenal. So, what can we expect from them this season? Lindsay Hooper is precisely the person to ask. Lindsay, who have they signed?
it might be easier to answer who they haven't bought in, because it's been such a busy window for London City Lionesses, easily the club that have done the most business this summer transfer window in WSL. And the changes have come right from the top. Martin Semmons joined as the club's CEO. He used to be the vice chairman and CEO at Southampton. So he's overseen a lot of big deals, concluding on deadline day with a world record deal of £1.43 million for Grace Gayoro from PSG. And she is an international French player, world-class midfielder. Many football fans will be aware of her talent. And she joined just after Lucia Corrales from Barcelona. She signed until 2029. That deal expected to be worth around £430,000. So much money spent. Although the club don't disclose in an entirety, we know it is going to be the most budget. And going through all the names, it would take me forever, to be honest. Nikita Paris, who's got lots of WSL experience. Katie Zellum comes back to WSL from America. Alana Kennedy as well was one of the more experienced players they signed. But Paola Partido, Freya Godfrey joining from Arsenal, Danielle van der Donk, the experience that she brings as well to this side. They are littered with talent. And to answer your question about can they compete at the very top, it might be too early for Michelle Kang's investment to have fruition for this season. I certainly expect them to have a top half finish, but look out for London City Lionesses in the future. I think in the next 2 to 3 years, they will be fighting towards the top of the league.
If you want to hear more from Lindsay throughout the WSL season, check out the Offside Rule podcast. It's her, it's Tash Dowie, it's really good. And there's a link in the episode description. Germany lost just their fourth World Cup qualifier ever and their first away World Cup qualifier ever as they slumped to a 2-0 defeat in Slovakia last night. Atletico Madrid's David Hanko and Middlesbrough's David Strelec grabbed the goals for the hosts, with Germany's £185 million of newly transferred talent, Florian Wirtz and Nick Voltermada, failing to make an impact. That is three defeats on the bounce and just one win in six for Julian Nagelsmann's side. He boasts a 50% win ratio with Germany, which always sounds really good at club level, but when you're talking about one of the most decorated and talented international outfits, it's really not. Seb Stafford-Blohr is on holiday right now, but rest assured, we'll be grilling him about this when he returns. Elsewhere in Europe, Yuri Tillemans celebrated being given the Belgium captaincy by bagging a brace in a 6-0 win over Liechtenstein. Matty Cash helped Poland hold Netherlands to a 1-1 draw with a late equaliser, and Mark Cucurella capped a genuinely brilliant spell of international form with his first goal in Spain's 3-0 win over Bulgaria. It was a fascinating night in the Conmebol corner of the football world, with four of the five home teams winning 3-0. Paraguay, the sole exception, with a measly goalless draw with Ecuador. We had Carlo Ancelotti getting his first win as Brazil boss, as Premier League trio Estevao, Lucas Paqueta and Bruno Guimarães all scored, with Estevao becoming the youngest Brazilian since Pelé to score in a competitive game. No pressure, young man. In Buenos Aires, Lionel Messi scored a brace in what is likely to be his last international in Argentina, and Colombia and Uruguay completed the 3-0 quartet with wins over Bolivia and Peru, respectively. Luis Suarez wants everyone to know he's very sorry for spitting in the face of a member of the Seattle Sounders coaching staff. I feel bad about what happened, and I didn't want to miss the opportunity to acknowledge it and apologise to everyone who felt hurt by what I did. Suarez posted on his Instagram stories, which for my money is the least sincere of all apology platforms. Suarez is yet to learn the full extent of his punishment for this vile act, but I've got a sneaking suspicion he won't learn his lesson this time, whatever it is. From the ridiculous to the utterly sublime now, as 54-year-old Dorking Wanderers fan Terry Dunn has answered the club's emergency call to solve their goalkeeping crisis. Dunn, a 28-years retired former keeper, said, "Playing in goal is like riding a bike. You never forget it." Dorking boss Mark White said, "What Terry lacks in mobility, he'll make up for in heart. And for one game, we'll just have to get on with it." It's hardly a vote of confidence from the gaffer, but Route 1 is rooting for you, Terry. In a moment truly befitting of international break madness, a league fixture in Tanzania between City FC Abuja and JKU FC was called to an emergency stop as a swarm of bees flew over the pitch, forcing both sets of players to play dead to avoid being stung. On closer inspection, VAR official Michael Salisbury insisted that it was the players who initiated contact with the bees and awarded all 3 points to Chelsea. Loads of football for you on TV tonight. The WSL gets underway. You can see Chelsea against Man City on Sky Sports, or you can catch up with the World Cup qualifiers. And as we established yesterday, no one has any idea what's going on. Some groups have started, some have not. Here's a little catch up for you. Group B begins tonight. Alexander Isak is in the Sweden squad. They go to Slovenia. Switzerland host Kosovo. One of those four goes to the World Cup. One goes to some rather complicated looking playoffs. Group C hasn't started yet either, and it is a doozy. Denmark face Scotland, Greece have Belarus, and again, it's a 14 group, so two of those teams will definitely not qualify for the World Cup. And Group D opens up with Ukraine against France and Iceland against Azerbaijan. Same rules apply. Group I actually has started, and the I stands for Italy are in trouble. They got walloped 3-0 by Norway in June. They did beat Moldova, but Norway's 4 wins from 4 means they're in the ascendancy. They, I think, are on their way to their first World Cup since 1998. Italy are scrapping for a playoff place. They play Estonia tonight, and if they don't win that, they could be in real bother. Remember, they haven't qualified for a World Cup since 2010, and they finished bottom of their group that year as well. And finally, there's Group L, where Croatia travel to the Faroes and Montenegro host the Czech Republic. Croatia have 2 wins from 2. The Czechs have 3 wins from 4. It's all a bit of a mess, quite frankly. You can watch the Scotland game on the BBC. The other big European games are on Amazon Prime. And if you want African World Cup qualifiers, they're all on FIFA Plus. That was Route 1. It was football fast, no faff. I've been Ian McIntosh. Your producer was Helena Fremantle. Chris Smith and Lola Cass-Roberts were in the writer's room. Work experience legend Joseph Tate has been teaching us about YouTube, so expect more on that next week. We'll see you then.